Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Ruth Hendricks. Ruth Hendricks teaches art at Arlington Accelerated Academy. She has studied poetry with Michael Worster, Jim Harms, and Tori Derricotte. She is a poet, photographer, and filmmaker. Her film, Court Jar Poet, featuring Dorothy Holly, premiered at Manchester Craftsman's Guild in 2005. Her work has been published in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and has been anthologized in Writing on the Desk, University of Pittsburgh Press, and the forthcoming anthology, After the Bell, Contemporary American Prose About School, edited by Maggie Anderson and David Hassler, University of Iowa Press. Hi, Ruth. How are you?
I'm good, Jan. How are you?
Good. It's good to have you. And you have some poems about school.
I do. I thought I'd start off with one about where I work, the art room.
Okay.
Art room ritual. There is something holy about the scent of crayons, and I pitch them, pairs of colors, careful not to spoil the points. I fill the dented aluminum pans, two red, two yellow, two brown, two blue, two of each color at a time. 400-plus names. I wonder who will eat them, want to throw them, explore an eager nostril. Someone will cut a crayon in half with scissors, another be devastated when one snaps in two. How many crayons pass through our hands in a lifetime? Paraffin plus pigment, waxy lines. Kindergartners draw first potato people. Shaky circles sprout legs, some eyes. A fortunate few hoard a hinged lid box of 64. Some tell me they don't have a single one at home. Last term's broken bits sit naked, wait for the grip of a thumb and forefinger to rub manila paper held on a cardboard flap. Make bricks, a house, some sky. Come June, we'll dump the pans out and we'll peel the labels off what's left. My next poem's about some generic student excuses that I experience. Sometimes I have to talk with a student in the hall. This one's called School Dialogue, Multiple Choice. You forgot to bring gym shirt, sign permission slip, homework, lunch. And it's in your backpack, locker, dad's house, don't know. Look, Connor, Stefan, Kayla, Jean, stop talking, get rid of your gum. I'm not talking, it wasn't gum. I'm chewing cough drop, paper, tongue, he's lying. Your hazel, brown, blue, green eyes wide, you look like you believe yourself. Did you think your pencil hockey, paper wad, crayon missile game would go unnoticed? No, you can't go to the lost and found, bathroom, office, fountain, nurse. You're in here just 45, 90, or absent minutes a week. This one, I was sitting at my desk and looked out in the hall. It's called Progress. At school, there's a Wrangler model 2730, slop-sucking scrubber machine. Mr. Ellis pushes it around the hallway. I watch as he guides it to glide over a puddle of vomit and wonder where it goes after he sucks it up. When I was in first grade, the janitor summoned, sprinkled some granular compound over a tiny urine lake or regurgitated cafeteria entree. Let it sit, soak, sweep it up, dump in a bin. I remember the odor, combination, cleanser and puke, powdered canister dust, mixed with sour breakfast or lunch. That hallway floor cleaning machine must have a scent in it too, and I wouldn't want to be the one to unlatch it, clean it out after a week in elementary school. I asked Mr. Lovelace how they empty it. You know, Mr. Ellis likes the scrubber. You squirt a hose real hard, and it all runs out onto the ground. But actually, just between us, ma'am, he said, I prefer the old-fashioned method myself. Now, on that theme, trying to break out of my burden of pleasantness, moving into a few nasty thoughts. And this is called Variations of Nasty. Still has school in it a little bit, though. A fruit fly infestation swarms locker 118 outside the first grade. There's a stench. James forgot his jack-o'-lantern, and it's almost Christmas. A giant eagle bag at the bottom under his lost coat, a pile of stuff. Did his mother notice? Nope. School cafeteria chicken patty, flower-shaped, like someone chewed it all up into pulp, put in a mold, pressed out, cooked a month ago in lots of fat, load on a truck, wheel it into a cooler and heat a bit, peel off the plastic seal. I watched the kids eat. A nasty migraine, nauseous and all, visual disturbances seventh period. I want to lie still in my bed at home. We're leaking garbage pails, captured dog feces in a plastic bag, warm and squished, tossed in a can. My bare feet step in cat puke, hairballs, as I find the bathroom in the night. Cold, nasty chunks wiped out between toes. Nasty acts involve body orifices, and even nasty thoughts send you straight to hell. I think I could spit on someone if required. She was in a nasty accident. Good. I was in a nasty mood. I watched my student teacher try to teach. I think of liver texture. And this guy I work with, a slacker for sure, tells nasty jokes in the hall, offends all women. He snickers. I squirm. Tell him to stop. He says if I'd been any good, my husband wouldn't have left me. So I write a whodunit. Takes place in a school, chapter one. The custodian rolls back the blue cover Monday morning, disgusting joke-telling corpse floating in the pool.
You've just tuned in. You're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Ruth Hendricks. Okay, I want to ask you about these nasty poems. You said something about the burden of pleasantness as a writer. Is
yeah. Growing up, you know, we were always encouraged to be nice and do what was correct. And write, take that high road. And sometimes you just want to veer a bit, so you're always tempted. But then when you do, you don't necessarily feel happy about it or good, but it's nice to be able to write in that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a relief.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it's an important point because we've all seen those poems where people don't acknowledge anything dark or real, really, in their poems, and they fall flat. But I also know that it's tough for a lot of writers to begin to acknowledge the darkness. So can you talk about how you finally came to that moment where you said, well, I'm going to write some of these nasty poems. She had an accident. Oh, good.
Yeah, it's not a good way to feel. But yet by writing it down, it sometimes it heals what you are thinking and you don't have to feel so bad about all the bad thoughts you do have sometimes because we all have them. It's just ignoring them and it takes a lot of energy to try to be nice all the time when, you know, not everyone deserves your being nice to them.
Mm-hmm. And also, we know that, you know, poetry is not autobiography. And
oh, no, of course not.
And we're making up
yes.
Stories.
These are all imaginary, exactly. Nothing autobiographical here.
Well, I mean, it brings up the idea of writing from one's life. And I think it's great that you're, you know, writing about school. I mean, this anthology that Maggie Anderson is coming out with, Contemporary American Prose About Schools, is going to be really interesting. Because I think a lot of writers think we can't write about our everyday lives.
It helps you make sense of what you are doing, and you spend so many hours in your work environment. And I do try to remain positive, but so much happens at school that you just can't even believe. And writing about it helps you make sense of what you're witnessing, and sharing it, I think, is healthy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to talk for a second about the voice in your poems. It's a welcoming, appealing voice, and I know you've been writing for a while. How do you think you got to that voice?
I think just writing and writing and writing and being myself and being true to myself, which does come out if you keep writing, eventually what you really need to get to does come out. It has to come out somewhere, better in your writing than to make yourself sick. So I found it very helpful to write things down and share them with others and have people hear and acknowledge and have people say, wow, I threw up in first grade too.
Okay. Let's hear some more poems.
All right. This is one that I wrote after an experience of going to a reading from a very famous poet, and I was prepared to buy all of her volumes of poetry with my money in hand. And it's called Elegy for a Gift of Roses, which the title was helped by Mr. Michael Worster, whom I studied with at the Pittsburgh Center for the Arts. And the poem is for the former poet laureate, Louise Glück. Your refusal of the extravagant bouquet stunned me as I sat second row center. Heard you say you were returning to your hotel room, and what were you supposed to do with them as tomorrow you'd fly out of the city? You could have smiled, accepted the lovely long stems, held them just a minute, cradled in the crook of your arm, held as a borrowed newborn. You could have smiled, offered thanks, lie, oh Pulitzer Prize-winning poet laureate. Later, back in your hotel room, you could peel back the tired spread, remove your top and pants, your underthings, rip petals from the stems and strew them, watch them float and fall to one side, where no one would sleep, or on the sheets where you would lie. Place a single petal on your tongue, ponder your mortality, cover each eye with one, rub the rest between your forefinger and thumb. Breathe in the scent of accompanying eucalyptus branches left under a shower stream in the hot tiled, steamy tub. You could leave the roses whole, fill the insulated ice bucket with warm water, and listen to them open during the night you had to sleep in Pittsburgh. Oh, laureate, you could dream of horses climbing hills. Next morning, housekeeping would discover your abandoned bouquet, think you really enjoyed your stay, had they found the crushed petals, traces of pink, all over the wrinkled linens. And this is another way I express myself to people I can't always tell something directly to. The art of a compliment. You've perfected the art, backhanded style. Put words together. Try to make me seethe, sweet smile. You tell me, oh my, why, this is the best I've ever seen you look. Like I've just crawled out of some pit, dirt under my nails, stringy hair, same old black skirt and top. Whoever made you feel like spit, now you try to pass it on or try. To you, I am haggard and wan, sallow or dour, untamed gray wisps. Maybe I am taking it, too, personally. You say you enjoyed my presentation when that wasn't it at all. Something about me must bother you, and when you saw me last, you feigned surprise, said you thought I'd moved. Never heard of me, from me, never saw me. No one ever mentioned me or where I had gone. Not so much different in the same room now with you. All right, this is one about my son who really helped me get back into writing poetry. He said, Mom, I think you've got something here and you need to write it down for yourself. It doesn't matter about sharing it with others. And so I'd like to dedicate this to him because he's the one that said, Mom, you're 50, you could live another 50 years, you know? You don't want to act like you're dead. And it's called Safety Measures. I will say that he has lived overseas for 2.5 years now, but I have seen him since he did come back for Steeler game. So, my son's Croatia-bound, Manhattan exodus, 6 months, a year, who knows? He craves adventure, the unknown. Opportunity to behold, oh, citizen of the world. How will you feel when it's Africa, Ma? This is Craggy Coast, Adriatic Sea Edge, Croatia, post-socialist republic. I never labeled the city of Zagreb on a purple ditto page, outline world map. Never wrote with a hand-sharpened colored pencil, Croatia, as a state, not a separate country in 64. Ma, didn't you want to backpack through Europe when you were 23? My adventure, married, residing at home near Goldfinger's vault. 2 years out of college to the day, I was in labor, gave birth to your older brother, Latin mask guy, the Marine. I stitched curtains to camouflage drab, multi-layer painted government quarters kitchen, devised company chicken recipe, knit blue baby sweaters, sewed sock monkeys, planted tomatoes in sawed-off oak barrels, and lined concrete slab patio perimeter with begonia-filled ammo boxes, nursing a happy baby, nestled into the gold plaid Herculon couch, answering Art Fleming on Jeopardy. My list of fears was much shorter then. Every ounce of my being held faith that I could make it better, salvage a marriage all nice, plow ahead smiling, create security, and sew, stroll, take baby walks, bake scratch birthday cakes and whole wheat bread. Write me when you get there. And this one's I Look for Signs. This was traveling to a wedding. And it's called I Look for Signs. Not mile markers or mail pouch faded on barns, but hand-painted crooked messages just for me, like trust in Jesus nailed to a tree at the soybean field's edge. One morning from Omaha to Ames, I watched the painted broken lines blur past. How many in a mile I forget, lost count. Hypnotized, I looked out the side window. I saw a pond reflect a billboard. Welcome to our manufactured home community. If you lived here, you'd be home now. A red-winged blackbird sits on a fence post, heck with OPEC tacked below. Someone told me, if you speak out loud to the dead, ask them to come, they'll hear and answer somehow.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Ruth Hendricks. I love how in your poems you talk about, you know, you notice the ordinary, and then in the course of the poem, we're transported to another place. And it reminds me of Louise Bogan. She has a great quote, something about, you know, the only thing we can do in certain moments is to notice what's around us and give the reader a bird's eye or a mouse eye view. And your work reminds me of that. I just love the way you do that. So in your estimation, is anything fodder for poetry?
I believe that it is, unless we're really hurtful to someone else. But that doesn't mean you couldn't write it. You just wouldn't have to share it. But I think that you can write anything, and you should. And you shouldn't censor. I've been told that by one of my teachers, you know, you should never censor. And I think it is important not to censor yourself. But I think a long time I wrote and was afraid to write something that might have been considered not nice. So I think I've broken out of that a little bit with some of my
I think you crossed that line.
Just a touch.
And it's an important one to cross. I mean, I know with some of my younger students, they're afraid to not be nice, and it's also a cultural problem I think we have. I was touched by, you know, you're talking about your son encouraging you to write and to explore. Do you share your work with him?
I do, and it was really clearly his college professors who got him writing, and then he passed it on to me, and I sent one of that poem that I'd written about him to the college professor who inspired him, and she wrote back the most beautiful letter to me, because it made her feel good to know that her teaching him had come back.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah.
I imagine, though, with you know, some of the school poems or some of the so-called nasty poems, which I don't think are nasty. They're just poems.
Branching out for me.
Yeah. I imagine the question of what can I write, what can I not write, if this is a so-called true story, you know, when do I change the names? When, you know, what do I need to change enough? And I think that's an important question, you know, in poetry. How do you deal with that?
Well, I have a poem that I've written about a student I had who didn't get along very well in school, and I taught him how to knit. But I'm kind of saving that poem for a few years because I do want to use his real name, and I'd like to do it with his permission.
Sure.
Because it's a great story. And I do have the scarf that he did knit for me. And he was really sent to me to be punished. And I said, well, if you're with me, you're going to have to knit. But that's an example of something where I'm not doing that publicly because I feel that it's not correct to do right now. But right. I would like to share that poem with him and then share it publicly because it's such an amazing story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great to get that permission.
Right.
Okay.
But I wouldn't want to use his real name, you know, right now. I just don't think it would be appropriate.
Mm-hmm. And certainly at a later date, you could, you know, alter the story.
That's
use
right.
a different first name, whatever.
Yeah, I can make him crochet.
For the sake of the poem. Okay.
But here's an example of what we're talking about.
Okay.
These are things, and the name of this poem is after, inspired by Aaron Smith after studying his book. And it's called Things I Never Tell Out Loud, But I Think About Sometimes in the Night. And that's just about where it comes, in the night. So it's good to write it down. I helped freeze Catherine Mears Brazier in a sleepover, 1963. The smartest girl in the class, except maybe Eleanor Gensler. I don't know how to use a slide rule. I stole a Raggedy Andy doll from a church nursery, 1959. A little red heart on a peach body, stamped, I love you. I told my mother to go to hell. I was uninvited to Susan Glantz's bat mitzvah, 7th grade, details vague. I still feel ashamed. I told my father Gail could drive a stick, no problem. He lent us his car. I shifted, told her when to put the clutch to the floor. I erased the one on the report card. Perfect attendance. I was too chicken to tell when I saw Aunt Shiva steal a bag of balloons by St. Virgil's. Even more chicken to stand guard or assist. I left a puddle of urine on a candy store floor, ran away, stashed panties under my bed, and acted like I didn't know what smelled like a hamster cage. I've lived semi-conscious, involuntary response for more years than I can admit. I can barely pray. I wouldn't know who to pray to if I could. I hear God speaks to a lot of people, not me. I buried liquor at the Jersey Shore, evaded the police line of questioning. I shot a water pistol stream onto the organist's back pant seam at choir. I buy cards I never send. Sometimes the people die before I get them mailed. I didn't make it to Illinois in time. Grampy died, border of Indiana and Ohio.
Nice poem. That was after Aaron Smith's poem, Things I Could Never Tell My Mother, which was after Denise Duhamel's poem, Things I Could Never Tell My Mother. But it's great to do that, to, you know, imitate the poems of other poets. Great poem.
And this is a poem people know me for because it's something I do a bit obsessively, and it's somewhat edited not to hurt people's feelings. Why I Knit. I sit and knit unnecessary baby sweaters for the chef's daughter, Chef Anna, who fed me gratis the night after I dumped the closet alcoholic man, healed by warm soup, spaghetti arugula. I sit and knit, not dwell on my daughter's Pierce Punk boyfriend discarding her as mattress kill, not thoughtful of her heart. Hope she'll pass all her courses full credit so the grant money escapes notice to rescind. I sit and knit, cease racing mine, Marines deploy Afghanistan, eldest son is promised Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh comes spring, but no military needs come first. I knit and purl variegated sweaters, grow in length, as days grow shorter for my almost 90-year-old father, who sits in a royal blue chrome-trimmed wheelchair, Illinois nursing home shared, with Woody, whose teeth fall out onto the linoleum. The television blares through the center curtain. The guy snores, mouth ajar, while Dad waits. Waits for help. Help to go to the bathroom. Waits to be wheeled to the dining room. Waits to be lifted out to bed. Waits for phone calls. Waits for his faraway children to come just for a brief space. Leave. He waits alone, again. Waits for my mother, destinations unknown. I sit and knit and turn, purl, and knit into mindless oblivion. And this is another one kind of at work along this theme. They wish you were done with it. It pains them to see me not care if they notice how my hair is pulled up wet, clasped in a bun, stuck to my head with a clip every day, the same tired outfit worn twice in a row. About 6 weeks is all they can stand. They tell you they like you better when you smile. Come to school all perky and nice. They'd rather not ask how you're doing. Some mumble sorry and hug your first day back. It hurts more now. They watch my visible, miserable frame. It's more than they can bear. I barely make eye contact. Keep my eyes low, walk down the hall and avoid conversation, somehow get through. Herbert stands in a line for the boys' room right by my door. I try to get by, slink into my room. He calls out real loud, "Hey, sorry, Miss Hendricks, I know how you feel. My dad passed, too." And here's one on a little lighter note. And I disappoint a lot of friends when I don't respond in the way they expect. It's called How Your Fate in This Universe is Determined. I didn't send the eight angels within 8 minutes to eight people, including you, so something long-awaited won't come to me. I didn't forward the unbroken chain novena or pass the Blessed Mother from house to house. I'm the one who broke it. Little flower, forgive me. I didn't save the earth or take that Dr. Phil test. Though your score was great, I deleted it. No, I didn't scroll all the way to the bottom either, or send it on to everyone still searching for the toothy smile, red-haired kid missing since 98. No one is going to mail money to you ever, or me, no matter how many times you think you saw it on morning TV, read in USA Today. "This is hilarious," you wrote, "worth reading a second time around. But what about the third, the fifth, or fourth? Bad luck may come to me, though you simply dial 1-800-FREE-411 and won't incur a dollar charge. Find that number. I should learn Heimlich maneuver on self. They say, this is information people don't mind receiving."
Just tuned in. You're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Ruth Hendricks, reading her poetry. I love the saturation of guilt throughout all these poems, and the and how you write about things that so many of us experience, but we don't maybe talk about. And there's a great relief in listening to a lot of that.
I do get a little worried when I don't forward that stuff, and I'm not sure why, because I don't consider myself superstitious, and yet I'm thinking, ooh.
That's that guilt stuff. That in the voice in the back of the head. But okay, we have time for a couple more.
Okay, great. This one's called Light at the Surface. I had an experience once in about fifth grade when I was saved from drowning, but of course the poem isn't about that at all. I remember a flower border, some louvered blinds, a beige vinyl chair. I didn't really know about dead. At 48, pretty much unscathed, for all I'd known was lightning bugs caught in a jar die by morning. I'd punched holes in the lid, but just air isn't enough to live. They make no noise when they expire. So I shocked myself as I plumped the pillow to give her ease, eyed the extra one by the hospital bed. I could stop her irregular grasp, the breaths, hold it hard down over her face. My sister told me, no, we can't, but I knew inside me I could stop my suffering. It hadn't even begun. Hours more we listened, turned into days. Mercy, I turned up the volume on the ceiling mount TV. Even a down pillow wrapped around my head can't muffle the dying sounds that still gurgle in my ears. I wake up drowning. And here's a little short one called Reassurance. I have trouble letting go of things. I think I read that great Burging poem recently in the Post-Gazette. Reassurance. The flowers are so lovely, dear, such a beautiful bouquet. I keep my mother's and father's voices on a broken answering machine. When I'm feeling especially bereft, I can plug it in, press the button, play back the messages they left for me. I play them, listen really hard, and try to hold them in my ears and in my heart. And now, I do have cats, but the dog people might not like this one, so it's a little dangerous territory. I sit on my stoop, and it's almost dawn. I watch a guy lead his dog, so it squats on my lawn. The early sun bores a hole through a branch, and I will a sinkhole to suck them both down to a molten core. Howls fill with dirt as the earth opens up, and tree roots rip turf, and the leash snaps in two, and his dog flies free to the sky.
The poetry of Ruth Hendricks. Thank you so much, Ruth. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wilk and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody here on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.